Okay, so we've had the opportunity to begin this exploration of the theme of love, attachment, and friendship. And I think it's helpful to consider it as an exploration, and this is part of the just investigation for ourselves. What's it mean to us? What does it? What kind of themes come up for ourselves when we reflect on this, or when we consider it, when we start bringing this into our hearts? And that's a important aspect of this, is that we, in all the different types of themes of Dhamma, is that we have to, that's one of the characteristics of Dhamma, is it has to, it's leading inwards, we have to draw it into the heart. And what does it feel like? What does it, what's the experience? And I think that that's where it's just that seeing the complexity of, say, I mean, there's three simple words: love, attachment, friendship, with, that are reasonably common in the English language, but they have layers of meaning, and they and both in terms of the positive aspects in the negative aspects, to be willing, again, the sense of willing to explore. What does that, what does it mean? What does it feel like? You know, we tend to want to have a sometimes like a simple definition or a clear definition, and these very human emotion and human experience it's not really encapsulated in a simple definition. Learning how to be comfortable with that kind of complexity, or that on a certain level, that tangle that is there, and on a certain level, that's loving kindness, where we're willing to be comfortable with that complexity. Is that sense of, because I think one of the things that, you know, was coming up in terms of the ways that we reflect on love in a very positive way, and in a deeper way, the sense of acceptance, of inclusion, of respect, of warmth, and these they're not simple definitions, and they're, but those are, you see, realize you're inclining to a certain, what makes it relevant, what makes it, say, useful or beneficial, wholesome. Similarly for attachment. It's usually, attachment is a buzzword in Buddhist jargon, that you can't be attached. What was it? Liam's joke the other day of
emails.
A Buddhist using email, but you can't, so long as you don't have attachments. So there. But you have these buzzwords that you think, you can't you know, attachment, no, you can't have that. But, you know, there again, it's not a simple definition, because the Buddha himself tended to use terms that were reasonably specific. Although, as we've looked at today, even the word that, say, piya, as a word for love or what is dear, is actually quite, it's just about as loose and ill-defined as love is in English. The sense of attachment is somewhat similar in the sense that, you know, really, if we don't form some kind of connection, and I think maybe that, like, connection with our practice or connection with what is really meaningful and beneficial, then that we on a certain level we need to be attached to our practice in order to maintain it, and or we have to have a love of Dhamma, and that's actually one of the qualities that the Buddha points to Dhamma chanda dhamma ragani. This, with that desire for the Dhamma, for that love of Dhamma. It's an idiom that's used when somebody they have this faith and love of Dhamma, attachment to Dhamma, desire for Dhamma, and they don't have a full insight yet, so they're not fully awakened. But because of this tremendous love of Dhamma and desire for Dhamma, that carries one into a realization of the noble fruits. And it doesn't take one to full enlightenment, but if one's on that path, and then it's assured. So it's a sense, where the Buddha actually uses a word. Usually, the word raga is like love and has almost a sexual meaning in the Pali. But then it's conjoined with dhamma raga. So this is like an intense love, where it's this is different. I wasn't expecting this. And so that sense of, but one always has to be paying attention. And I think this is one of the things that, in terms of how do we hold things from a Buddhist perspective, or how would the Buddha have us view things? And so often, what the Buddha is trying to get us to investigate is, how do we hold things so that that which is wholesome and skillful increases, and what is unwholesome, unskillful decreases? And what is it that makes, say, bright states of mind increase and kind of clouded and disturbed states of mind dissipate? So those are, you know, how do we increase happiness and decrease suffering? And so those are parameters that we need to be investigating along with and sometimes even opposed to the way we define or assume things. Again, that sense of, you know, if I were a good Buddhist, I wouldn't have any attachments. I mean, if I were a good Buddhist, I would meditate more. Now, these are all ideals that we kind of assume into existence or assume into reality. And that sense of, you know, idealism could just be so problematic. And we can transfer that idealism to, say, like our friendships and relationships, and where we try to set up some sort of ideal that we think we should be accomplishing, and we try to measure other people by some ideal with that we're holding them to, and then wonder why we suffer. But it's, you know, it's so often it's that misplaced idealism and living in a conceptual realm rather than paying attention to experience and coming back to experience. And that's where I think the Four Noble Truths are such a foundation for our practice and our training, and again, not in a doctrinal way or even in an idealized way, but in, this is how we come back to our experience. There is this experience of discontent, dissatisfaction, dis-ease, stress, suffering in some way, shape, or form. And to learn how to hold it and be present with it in order that we can really pay attention to what's behind that? What's the cause of this? What's the conditions that are setting this up? What am I contributing to it? What is the external circumstances that are contributing to it? What are the internal circumstances? So we can start to investigate it and explore it a bit more clearly. And once we, and then of course once one recognizes, okay, there's something. Because sometimes it's an external problem, and this is where the Buddha is quite clear. And, you know, sometimes you have to pay attention to the people that you, say, the friendships that you have, the people you associate with, the circumstances that you're involved with, because they affect you. And so again, when the Buddha, in the teaching where the Buddha gives the teaching on the highest blessings, I mean, the very first thing that he says is the highest blessing is to not associate with fools. Don't associate with people who aren't good for you, and that's a blessing. So he's not sort of coming at an idea from an idealistic sense of you have to love everybody and you have to get along, you have to forgive everything, and sometimes you have to cut your losses and bail. But then there's also the sense of, you know, well, what are we contributing to an unskillful or an unwholesome situation? What attachment do we have? What projection do we have? What kind of trustworthiness are we bringing? Because I sort of say a lot of the seal, like of keeping of precepts and is not so much about moral injunctions, but around this is the foundation for healthy relationships. You know, when you have lay a foundation of trust in the honesty and the good intention of non-harming, of not not deceiving. That's a fundamental foundation of really skillful relationships. You know, whether that's in business or in social situations, or whether it's with one's life partners. You know, that's your foundation for trust. And you know, it's a real an act of caring. It's also, the Buddha calls it like an act of generosity. And the greatest, a great mahadana, a great gift, it's a great gift to others to live in a way that is rooted in that sense of integrity. But then, of course, to have that sense of kindness and care and concern and warmth and love. We also have to say, okay, what about in terms of our, again, our sense, this sense of ideals and idealisms and expectation. We have to recognize sometimes what we contribute sometimes. It's like, years ago, one of the nuns at Amravati had a lot of difficulty with her family, parents in particular, and it was distressing on both sides. One, that the daughter was a nun and a Buddhist, and then of course this lack of understanding was painful for the daughter, the nun, and one time she asked Ajahn Sumedho, you know, what can I do to create more understanding between us and a more easeful relationship. And Ajahn Sumedho is sort of off, as oftentimes happens, these things sort of come off the cuff or come out of nowhere somehow. And he said, oh, the kindest thing you could do for your parents is to not create them. And that, you know, because we create a sense of who they are, who they are in relation to us, and that's a projection, and with that projection comes complications. And it's just learning how to really be present with one's own experience and their experience, because that's where that same learning how to be comfortable with dukkha is not just suffering silently and getting oneself attuned to a low level of misery. It's a willingness to open the heart to the whole realm of experience, and that's an act of love. That's an act of kindness. That's an act of caring that we give to ourselves and we give to others, because because you realize you don't need to be intimidated by a feeling of discomfort or a sense of not being fulfilled. I mean, it's just so ordinary. But when we are able to move toward that, to hold it, then there's all sorts of opportunities open up. One can really start to listen. One can pay attention to what's actually going to be useful, what's going to be beneficial, what is helpful, either for myself uh, or and or within the situation. So there's an attunement that comes, and that's a that's something that is quite quite say rooted in these Four Noble Truths. I mean, you think of Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path. This is like I've heard this all before. But it's, you know, it's okay, that's sort of Buddhism 101, let's get on to the real stuff. But you realize that the Buddha, over and over, through 45 years of teaching, he keeps saying, I teach only two things, dukkha and the cessation of dukkha. And it's sort of, everything comes back to those Four Noble Truths. And just learning how to be willing to bring our own experience back to that. And again, not in a doctrinal way or an idealistic way, but in an experiential and a kind way. A way, and I think another word that came up when we were speaking of what does love mean? And I think respect is one that was used. And I think that's one of the aspects of love is also whether it's love toward oneself or love for others, whether it's a love for parents or again or love, whatever relationship there is, but then it's also this kind of respect that is there, and I think that helps to take it beyond the bounds of a selfish love, and so that sense of respect and where one is recognizing, honoring the humanity of each being, and that is, and by doing that, of course, that's a great way of, you know, it's a great act of kindness toward ourselves, because we really, giving ourselves the respect, because that's the other side of the tendency to self-criticism, self-hatred. Those are the other side of the coin. When we're able to turn that, then it comes back to a giving oneself of respect, and that's an act of kindness toward oneself. The sense of using these, again, these fundamental teachings, but learning how to deepen one's exploration of them in a way. Because just like one picks up a theme of love, which you realize, okay, that's really tangled and not really easily defined, but then start teasing it apart and start exploring it and realizing, okay, this has got real possibilities of growth here and understanding. And similarly with just going back to those noble truths of exploring the nature of our experience and being able to know more clearly, and then that sense of letting go and learning how to, because again, you want to start teasing apart this sense, okay, letting go of attachment can often seem as a dismissal or some magical thing that one does. I'll just let it all go and I'll be happy, but it's a that sense of letting go is also a, yeah, it's an act of love. It's an act of kindness to release or relinquish the various attachments that we do have, or the expectations that we do have. And you know, I think that's one, like, certainly, I mean, I trained with Ajahn Chah, and he to me, he epitomized the somebody who had incredible loving kindness. I mean, just this, really, in terms of, like, boundless loving kindness, and with that came a charisma and a tremendous warmth. But he didn't need anything from us. He didn't need anything from anybody. And if you actually, and if you wanted something from him, then other than, say, example, guidance, you wanted acknowledgement, or you wanted to bask in that warmth of his loving kindness too much, you get sent off to some ghastly branch monastery to chill out. And and to a certain degree, that sense of, you know, like, letting go is really the essence of where, you know, peacefulness is. And that's there's a quote in the Sutta Nipata where the Buddha says, you know, see how letting go of the world is peacefulness. So I guess, yeah, this is letting go of the world, letting go. And when we say world, the Buddha defines world in all sorts of different ways. Sometimes he's asked, well, what is the world? He says, a world is the eye, you know, sight, sound, smells, taste, touch, mental objects. This is the world. And that's, or that whereby one perceives the world and one conceives the world, that is the world. So as it turns it back on us and say, okay, this is the world. But see, letting go of the world is peacefulness. And there's nothing that you need hold on to, and there's nothing that you need push away. And so that it's that holding but not desperately holding. You're letting it go, but you're not pushing it away. It's this balance that is very clear, very peaceful, and very kind. It's the kindest thing one can do. There's also an idiom in the, I think it's in the commentarial literature, speaking about the, say, enlightened beings, awakened beings, and they say, they so love the world that they have let go of it completely, which is very beautiful. It's not an act of aversion, but an act of love. So yeah, again, this word love is so nuanced and so sometimes overused in the world, but I think it's helpful to explore it, because there's a richness there that is important to tap into, that gives us some guidance in terms of, well, what is helpful to be cultivating in my relationships with others, and whether they are, you know, as they say, the social relationships, work relationships, relationships of life partners, those are having that foundation of a wholesome root to it, a real skillful root to it, because as human beings, when you think, what's the worst punishment that is sort of meted out to people as given? Solitary confinement. That's considered torture. And as much as when you're really irritated and fed up with people, you say, I wish I didn't have to deal with people. But the reality is, as human beings, we're very much dependent and need to have these relationships. And it's important to pay attention to how to cultivate relationships that are based in really wholesome qualities, there's loving qualities, there's care and kindness. Because they nurture ourselves, but they also it nurtures our relationship with others, and that's, you know, living in the world. You don't for all of the how do you say the mythology of the kind of the rugged individual in American movies and literature, it's not how human beings actually live, and it's important to be able to bring that foundation to something that is really say grounded in truth, and of course that truth and Dhamma are interchangeable. So those are some meanderings of thought, and maybe open it up for discussion and see if anybody's got any reflections. Because this topic, when we were deciding on, okay, how are we going to approach this topic on, because we, for those who are returners to the Upasika days, you see, we set it up in different ways sometimes. Sometimes there's split it off into small groups, or sometimes it's one person, or sometimes there's readings, and this was sort of, okay, I think this is important to come together as a bigger group, and then each of us giving some reflections, and we'll just see where it goes. We don't have a clear sense of where this is all going or where it's going to end up. But also getting people to explore this together. So any reflections? Yeah, Tony. Yeah.
So for myself, I mean, the whole subject of love is hard because my natural tendency is to push the world away.
Yeah.
And I feel like I made some progress. But, you know, one of the greatest things for me has been sort of to adopt, you know, this attitude of enjoyment is wrong, and having an aesthetic outlook on life, and felt that at first I was raised Catholic, and then got into, you know, very ascetic Hindu traditions.
Yeah.
And some of that I carried it over into my Buddhist practice, and not because anyone told me that was right, but I had it like, sort of stuck in my brain.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm working on appreciating and enjoying life and trying to enjoy life.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, always rub up against doing that in a wholesome way.
Yeah.
also don't know where I'm going with what I'm saying, but I guess I just found it out that I'm wondering what you think about that, and if you have any ideas
Yeah, I mean, I think one is our Judeo-Christian background really conditions us you can't enjoy yourself too much. You're falling into sin, but I think with the the reason I'm looking at my computer is because I had some. It struck a bell from the rule of Saint Benedict. That was the first guide to monastic training and sort of a sense of the. Moving in a spiritual training, but it and because Saint Benedict probably 600-700 years after 600-700 AD wasn't that long, was it? So it's 1600-1700 years ago, and. But there, there was so much the sense of how they conceived of self, the early Christians and early Catholics in particular. That sense of truly, we are forbidden to do our own will, for Scripture tells us, "Turn away from your desires," and then. A man not only admits with his tongue, but is also convinced in his heart that he is inferior to all and of less value, humbling himself and saying with the prophet, "I am truly a worm, not a man, scorned by men and despised by the people." It's no wonder we're so screwed up. And I remember the... years ago, there's a talk by Ajahn Sujito, and the title caught me, but I didn't recognize the reference, because of course sometimes Ajahn Sujito is so clever in his use of language and concepts, and he's a very well written. But anyway, it's the talk is titled "Fellow Worms." And he's making fun of that, but it is it's something that sticks in our psyche, even if we grew up, rejecting it, or not even knowing that it was part of our cultural heritage. But it seeps in, and I remember one time. There's a great BBC documentary on the royal family in Thailand. It was done in the 1970s, and the interviewer is sitting with the king in his. I mean, it's in the palace. It's in the. In his communication room, he's got this incredible. I mean, this is in the 70s, and he's just got every kind of electronic gadget that he could find at the time that he's tuning in to find out as much, keep in contact with as much of the realm as he could. And but anyway, and of course he's also got he's a solid practicing Buddhist, and he's. Anyway, the interviewer, BBC interviewer, is asking the king of Thailand and about, you say, see this, you've got, Buddhist shrines and you're a Buddhist and this is a Buddhist kingdom, and what does Buddhism have to say about original sin? And the king looks really puzzled, and he said, "But original sin, they don't really think like that. They think more like original purity." So it's really beautiful. Where the king is kind of stumped. I said, "Well, you know, why would anybody think like that?" But from a Buddhist perspective, the Buddha speaks of defilements and stains to unconsciousness, but those are what is called thills. Those are visitors. They come and go in the mind. And what we have the opportunity to do is to tap back into a fundamental purity or well-being that is there. Also, there's in this, the discourses, there's many discourses that are, again, because this is an oral tradition, then there's a lot of repetition. And so there's stock phrases that come up over and over again. And there's a series of discourses where the Buddha speaks of the causal conditions in growth and development in understanding and wisdom. And starting different starting points. Sometimes the starting point will be wise reflection. Sometimes the starting point would be virtue. Sometimes the starting point would be dukkha. But then it leads into, with this as a causal condition and this and this and this. Then there's the arising of delight. And then with the arising of delight, there's the arising of joy. And then with the arising of joy, there's the arising of tranquility. The arising of tranquility, there's the arising of happiness. The arising of happiness, there's the arising of samadhi, or meditative stillness. And in some of those discourses, the Buddha actually stops and says, the happy mind is easily concentrated, or is easily settled. And then it's with say, meditative stillness or samadhi as a foundation, and there's the arising of seeing things as they truly are. Seeing things as they truly are, then there's dispassion. So the things of, say, like of dispassion, letting go, these are rooted in delight, joy, tranquility, happiness. And of course, those are all, they're skillfully cultivated, skillfully accessed, and they bring beneficial results. So it's a different relationship to happiness and not to be in the same way that there's a word in the scriptural language for it has a. It's really hard to translate because it's oftentimes it's translated as merit, and it just doesn't get it. And in the Pali it's punya, in Thai it's bun, and so often Thai people ask, "Bun, how do you translate bun into English?" And I said, "I don't know. I've been trying for 40 odd years, and I don't have a good translation for it." But often, punya is translated. But what it means is the wholesome results of skillful action. So, which is a circular way of talking about it. Often, this standard translation is oftentimes merit, because it's But there's a discourse where a couple of discourses where the Buddha said, monks, do not be afraid of punya. Because sometimes that's saying, punya is another word for happiness. Because oftentimes they sort of, I got to go for liberation and meditative attainments. And he said, no, this is not disconnected from our skillful action, our skillful living, the happiness that comes from wholesome relationships, from wholesome action. These are not separate.
Well, I have a question.
Yeah.
Thought came to mind, say, with the parami of giving, you know, how there's the different levels of giving, kingly giving, etc.
Yeah.
And my understanding, those are all considered good, but it's kind of like good, better, best sort of a thing. Like there's a hierarchy or whatever. And I'm wondering if there's any similar teaching around, say, love or attachment. I know there's even different terms, but if there's any sense of like, okay, you know, this is like a good attachment, but then this is the better one, this is the best one, etc. If there's any similar teaching around that. I'll open it up.
I'm drawing a blank. Definitely in the with giving, then there's these different ways that he expresses it. With attachment or with love, I'm not getting the bells are not ringing. There certainly are aspects of as I talked about, of this different ways of where the Buddha even uses the word dhammaraga, which is, I think, when you see that, it sort of jumps out as a conflict of terms, but it is an idiom that he uses. So it is just, and the Buddha was really, as a teacher, he was incredibly skilled at turning language to his advantage, or using terms that were familiar at the time of the Buddha, turning it so that it had meaning in his. So, like, even the word like khanda just means lumps or piles, and whereas that he used it in a specific terminology referring to the things that we attach to as self, aspects of body and mind, but specific to your question, I'm drawing a bit of a blank. Somebody with more knowledge than me might do better.
Well, I don't have more knowledge, but just a certain reflection that comes up is a couple of things. One, that just in relation to attachment or holding, it seems like there are gradations of, what it is that you're holding to or what it is that you're attaching to can have increasingly skillful results or increasingly wholesome results. So, as Longpa has said, it's not like the Buddha said, don't hold to anything, don't attach to anything. It's to learn to hold to the right things, learn to attach to the right things that'll keep you, moving along a path towards acquisition, holding of more wholesome qualities. And of course, the very end point is letting go of all of those, as we know. But it involves a lot of holding and attachment in skillful ways. Mindfulness itself, just mindfulness, is a way of holding. It's holding a certain object of reference in mind to reflect on. So, you know, in a sense, mindfulness is one of the most skillful forms of holding or attachment. And just sort of my thoughts in terms of love is the development of wholesome qualities through relationship to people. In whatever form it takes, you take that on and you develop it to its fullest. And then, and it seems like to me, in its most progressive form, you take those very skillful qualities that you've learned in, you know, whether it's in a relationship with one person or a relationship with parents or children or whatever the relationship is, and you use those as ballast for holding those same kinds of feelings, qualities, concerns, ways of relating to all beings. So it's not a matter of dismissing one over another, but developing them in whatever way and then expanding into a broad way of being that isn't, you know, exclusive. That all of those qualities can be carried, that you've learned, into, you know, a very broad, pervasive, boundless quality without discrimination.
Yeah, I think that example of the broadening circles of and the teachings on those remind me a little bit, I mean, not exactly, but kind of going back to my original thought about, let's say, the different levels of giving, it's almost like the different levels of metta, you know, like starting in a smaller circle and going out and out and out until it's unlimited. Sort of.
Yeah. And just the same as with dana or giving, you know, the more superior forms are those without any expectation of return. It's just freely given. Same with love.
I haven't read this within a long time, but the is there a sutta about preparing the town to the village and then the bare earth to the, it gets progressively more and more, but there's a preference for more simple and more basic?
I think what comes to mind is the Lesser Discourse on Emptiness, where the Buddha is using, expanding on the sense of emptiness and where the Buddha is saying, well, this speaking of the, okay, but this hall, you know, here in Kapilavatthu or Savatthi or wherever he is empty. It's empty of horses and elephants, but it's not empty of people. And then he said, okay, well, and then developing that theme of okay, if it were empty, and then and expanding it out to just the elements, and then the elements disappearing so that they're. That's what comes to my mind, and the Buddha uses that theme. I can't remember the number of that sutta, 100 and something. But that's the Buddha's, that's what comes to mind, is the Buddha's discourse on emptiness, and because emptiness is not an absolute or a metaphysical quality, but is a relative quality. We're not trying to enter into some metaphysical realm. What we're doing is relinquishing coarser aspects, so that, you know, and that can be applied with, say, like with generosity or with love, where we, by relinquishing something that's coarser, we're able to move into something that is more refined, more beautiful, more satisfying.
Jen, I was just thinking or brainstorming in relation to the guy in white at the front, sorry, I don't know your name, that there's actually two types of desire. It's not quite the same as love.
Yeah.
So there's kind of chanda, which everybody cheers at, and that's good love and hooray for that. And then there's sort of tanha, which is everybody boos at that, and it's bad desire that's going to lead to no good, really.
Yep.
So that's a kind of gradation.
That's a kind of gradation.
It's
Yeah. Or, well, where like in the that use of piya as what is dear, what one has affection for, what has bias for, and then metta, which is a bit more boundless. So there's a certain element there. So those are. But yeah, I think the. The Buddha was the teachings are so rooted in practical experience that sometimes even if it's not explicit, in the same way that the different gifts and giving are different gradations, and there is even if it's not explicit, there is an implicit recognition that. Yeah, there's going to be spectrums of everything, so even relinquishment and letting go. I mean, we're able to let it go this much, but there's still this left. And being willing to recognizing that we have to tune into that nuance of spectrum in order to really get a good feel for the practice and training what the Buddha's pointing to. Yeah.
When you're saying that, something you said earlier, this is what arises for me, and you can explain it more, that spectrum, because it's so words that I weren't grown up with skillfulness and wholesomeness.
Yeah.
And that has that spectrum to reflect. What does that mean? What are the different...
Yes.
What does that mean, these levels of skillfulness or wholesomeness?
Yeah, it's wonderful to have something that's unknown in the language that you don't have many associations with. So then you can flesh it out in your own way. Whereas, say, something like love, we've already got layers on top of it. And so then... So sometimes Buddhist jargon is helpful, and sometimes it's not. But it is true that sense of it needs to be fleshed out. Yeah.
Could you say a bit more about the process of change? Because a lot of what you're talking about is talking about attunement or moving from a lack of acceptance or just. Mm. Change which arises.
Yeah.
And to me there seems to be an element of mystery or magic in it, that you can have as big a toolkit as possible and you can apply it with all the best of intentions, and sometimes magical things happen and sometimes nothing happens.
Right.
And I just wonder if you could offer some thoughts on the process of unfolding, or to what extent do we have any control over that?
Well, I mean, I think one of the, acts of loving kindness is to relinquish control, on a certain level. I think that sense of change and you've been hearing it for 40-odd years of how Ajahn Chah would express like impermanence as a sense of uncertainty or unsure in my name. Because, the sense of the uncertain nature of how things are going to unfold And I think part of the practice, one is just learning how to be comfortable with that, because sometimes it surprises you in a really, really incredible ways, in good ways, and then sometimes it's sort of, wow, that surprised me. It really sucks, and. But that sense of the uncertain nature of things. But what we're you know, a lot of practice and the tools of practice are helping us to understand the nature of cause and condition, and how everything is in this dynamic change, flux, that is being affected by causes and conditions from the past, causes and conditions in the present moment. And to a certain degree, we're not really sure how it's going to... There's certain patterns that are pretty dependable, but we can be surprised a lot. And again, both in a delightful way and sometimes in a way. So that being able to exert the control, because we do have the control to turn our attention to things that are helpful or that are we deem as beneficial or useful. But then, not all the information is in yet, and we might need to change our assumption because we're learning from that process. So that fundamental to the Buddha's teachings is this teaching on dependent arising, how everything arises dependent on causes and conditions, and there's not some external control being placed on there, or there's not some internal fixed thing that is making it absolutely certain. Being able to be comfortable with uncertainty. Of course, the more clarity and mindfulness we can cultivate, the more sense of security or stability we'll feel. And that's not ungrounded. It really... It's got an appropriate foundation.
Sometimes the mind is so stubborn.
Yeah.
So the internal control, I told myself that sometimes it listens.
Sometimes it listens and sometimes it doesn't. Yeah.
The lady and as the boss and employee, she's like pick on me. You know, she's like she had very sad breakout with her mom. Her mom abused her, and she hate women. So I'm like the only one. Of the woman in the company, so she can be angel and devil. It depends on which way she's gonna swing.
Yeah.
And then she didn't treat me well like other people. So sometimes I was angry, but. Sometimes I can control myself that I'm practicing metta, loving kindness. So, and then I treat her nice even though she was nice, was not nice to me. Sometimes I could do, but sometimes her face is just in my mind. It's very bothering me.
Yeah.
So when I see her, I have to pay metta.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wish her well. And she nice to me after I did that. It's like on and off like that. I was very stressful for a few months, but after that I kind of getting better, better, and she more friendly, and I thought I forgave her, but still sometimes it triggered my mind that I see her face too much. I didn't want to see her face, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like a loving kindness and forgiveness. Sometimes it's helped me, and meditation helped me, like make me talk with myself more, like, I don't want to be a bad person. I'm practicing.
Yeah.
And it makes me see a little bit more clear, but still sometimes it's come back bothering me.
Yeah, well, see, that's the suffering. You know, and it's not, but the reality is that sometimes we want it to follow the pattern. You know, we want to follow the program that we have set. If I give metta, then she'll stop bothering me, or she'll stop bothering me, or I'll stop thinking of her because I'm giving metta. I mean, it's the thing. You know, we're starting to strike a deal with our mental states, and I think it's not that one isn't doing the right thing. One's doing the right thing, but it's not going to follow your program just because you want it to. But it means, and it doesn't mean we stop doing it. But it's like relinquishing that control of it's going to follow my timeline or my expectation. So then that opens up space. That's another act of loving kindness to yourself. So it's you give loving kindness, you send loving kindness or have loving kindness for her, but you have loving kindness for yourself also with the discomfort you feel or the kind of dis-ease that comes up. So just being able to hold yourself in kindness.
Sometimes I thought it was my karma in the previous life.
Well,
something to her before. Well, I had done something to anyone before, so I pay for it.
Yeah, well, that's a... It sometimes people talk like that, especially in Thailand, and I have a doubt. You know, sometimes it's just too formulaic. You know, we think of it too formulaic. I think it's more important to come back. Well, what am I feeling, and what can I do about it? How do I work with it?
Before listening to that, I'm reminded of what the example you gave before about how in the highest blessings, that first one about avoiding foolish ways, and probably sometimes having metta for oneself or even the situation is to not to stay thinking I gotta deal with this, is to say, okay, you deal.
You
can deal with her issues with her mom or whatever. And I'm going to go to the next room and get my work done.
I mean, that's definitely, if there's a clarity there and a kindness there, it's not a bad option sometimes. Gives you some freedom. Okay, let's wrap. We're moving towards the end of the day, and why don't we take this last bit of time to sit quietly, sit meditation, and to let this, I mean, there's been a lot of information, a lot of reflection, a lot of words have been used, and I think to let the mind settle, and then see what comes up, what seems to be of help or benefit for oneself or being able, because we had these themes of love, attachment, friendship, but just opening the whole thing up and say, well, what is a what was useful, what was helpful, what can I take, what kind of, say, resolution would be good for carrying forward. You don't have to think about it too much, but just letting things resonate and settle and see what pops into the mind. We close with a chant, Buddha's words on loving kindness, which is on page 37 of the dark brown book. It's in English, and it gives the Buddha's perspective on the cultivation of, say, loving kindness, metta. And there's lots that's interesting in that. I think one is the in cultivation of loving kindness, he spends a lot, but the first third, talking about different actions, qualities, ways of doing things, being that, so not jumping into an ideal immediately, and then also spreading to all beings, and whether they're weak or strong, omitting none. It was just that sense of undifferentiated, and then it's interesting to at the end, and the loving kindness is just not holding to fixed views. It's an act of loving kindness to being freed from all sense desires, not holding to fixed views. This is a supreme act of loving kindness. So. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be at ease, whatever living beings there may be, or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Okay, so that concludes our program for the day. Just to express my delight, appreciation that people came out, participated, joined in.